And the sun took a day off and the moon stood still. The only light was in sight with the one just past that old onion field. If you look from where I'm standing, you see that old scarecrow. They say if you look too long, you might jump off that wooden bowl. But between you and me, I think that's just a bunch of, hey, you know. Some even believe he responsible for the death of old man Dan. They found without his thinking cap with straw in his hand. And the strangest thing about it is that they never found his head. They never found his head. They never found his head. God damn it. They never found old man Dan's head.
And they'll never find it. Cause I took
look,
it.
It didn't go like that at all. See, I just hated that his eye was crooked, and I wanted his eyeball. And things got out of hand, and old man Dan had to die because of that eye.
Yeah, I tell you, them scarecrow stories are lies. But I did hear when the moon was full and the sun's about to rise, you can walk by and think about that head at the crack of dawn, he'll cry.
And the sun took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the moon got a frown cause he could see it all from the
and
top.
And the sun took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the sun be clowning.
And the sun took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the stars come to work all drunk.
And the sun took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the moon got a frown cause he could see it all.
In a small town of 1,500 houses on every corner lived the oldest lady in the world, Alona. Miss Desmona Lorraine Cortez from Barcelona, Spain says she came to reclaim her family's name and put her soul to rest. Yes, on sacred ground. Her family owned this town and the people in it too, but I would just pass through. She said people around here believe in voodoo, witchcraft taboo. It was kind of hard for me to take this all for true, but she did say when a stranger comes to town, huh, it is what they do. First they'll stone you, and when you come to, then they'll own you. There's no one to run to when the sun takes a day off and the moon stands
still.
Well,
this is what I heard. The sun blew a fuse and the moon had stood in loom. Now morning came with rain and went from wetness down to evening sang the birds. The lamp of sun begun to fade throughout the noon. A piano plays a tune in which a woman's voice softly croons adamantly. She yells uncharacteristically, dance with me, you fool. But not only was I introduced, but apparently being seduced, but by whom? For namesake, let's just call a little mysterious lady maroon. Fresh from San Luis Cantoon, whisper things in my ears and make the flesh of a grown man's hand move. Suspensefully hypnotic, neither erotic nor exotic, but psychotic in a sense. For instance, she made reference to actually raising the dead. In a sentence, she once said with dread. And the sun took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the moon be locked in his room doing shrooms.
The sun took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the moon be in a hot air balloon to the moon.
And the sun took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the moon just be faded, crying.
The sun and took a day off and the moon stood still.
Around my part of town, the moon got a frown cause he could see it all from the top. And sometimes he'll stop, look out with a star gaze. Sometimes he'll cover his face and he won't be seen for days. The sun had took a day off and the moon stood still. The sun had took a day off and the moon stood still. For real.
And the moon stood still. That was AC Alone. Hey, everybody, this is Global Val. Thanks for listening to Women's Magazine on Mutiny Radio. It is Friday, November 7th, a fine day, the year 2014. What a day. And speaking of the moon, did you guys see that big old full moon last night? I always love seeing the moon coming up over the eastern horizon. It's always the biggest, right, when it just starts to rise. And I hope you all caught it. And speaking of catching things, you know, the moon holds sway over more than we even recognize, I believe. And people were throwing things, dropping things all over the place yesterday, just blown by the power of the moon, I say. So thanks for listening to Women's Magazine. So today I want to read a little bit from a new book that was sent to me here at Mutiny Radio. And it was sent to me by Voice of Witness. which is an organization located right here in the Mission. And its mission is to share oral histories. And so on ongoing human rights crises and various social issues. And so it's a nonprofit. So it uses Voice of Witness is a nonprofit organization that uses oral history to illuminate contemporary human rights crises in the U.S. and around the world. Its book series depicts the injustices through the oral histories of men and women who experience them. The Voice of Witness education program brings these stories and the issues they reflect into high schools and impacted communities through oral history-based curricula and holistic educator support. Check out voiceofwitness.org. And they're always doing a lot of work, a lot of great work over at Voice of Witness. And if you are a teacher, you can download some free curriculum from their website. And they also have books as well. I had a friend who did a project with her class, and basically all the students had to go and interview somebody about their lives, and it's kind of a life story process. So they interview someone kind of from the beginning into the now, and after they interview, then you have to transcribe the interview, and then it gets kind of edited down, not changed per se, but just kind of pared down so that it tells the story from the first person, and is really telling history from the bottom up as opposed to from the top down, which is what we usually get. So Voice of Witness has done a lot of different books. They've done books on Katrina, Voices After the Storm. I also interviewed Mimi Locke, who's the executive director of Voice of Witness. She also won the Smithsonian Award for Ingenuity in the category of social progress in 2013. And I also interviewed Audrey Petty, who was the editor and compiler of one of their books that came out about a year ago now, called High-Rise Stories, Voices from Chicago Public Housing. And their latest book that this might be a preview, folks. You might actually be, I don't know if I'm supposed to do this, but I guess I am as a member of the press because they sent it to me. I think this book hasn't quite come out yet, but the title of this book is Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation. It was compiled and edited by Kate Malik and Mateo Hoke. So let me jump into this book here and read somebody's story to you. And I think we're going to start with the story from Ibitsam Izgayer, who is a cultural center director. Let's see what she has to say. Ibitsam is the director of a cultural center. She's age 54, born in Batir in the West Bank, and was interviewed in Bethlehem in the West Bank. These are some notes from the editor before they tell the story, before Ibitsam's voice tells the story. During our dozen or more meetings with Ibitsam in her office, her black hair is either pulled back into a slick ponytail or falls to her shoulders in tight curls. She speaks with us in English, and she has a distinct accent influenced by her time studying at Newcastle University in northern England. When she stands, she adjusts a clamp on the knee brace in order to walk. This is due to a childhood bout with polio, which she contracted when she was 2 years old. Ibitsam is the director of the Giras Cultural Center, which she helped found in 1994. Giras, which means young trees in Arabic, serves more than 1,000 youth annually in the Bethlehem region through enrichment programs in reading, traditional Palestinian arts, and more. The center also provides literacy programs for women, generally mothers who are learning to read so they can take a more active role in their children's education. The walls of Ibitsam's office are decorated with awards and framed drawings by children who have passed through the center. Throughout her day, children stop by to share their successes and an improved test score or a list of books read during the month. And Ibitsam takes time with each one to congratulate and to encourage them and to laugh with them. She spends most of her time at the center, and she works 5 or 6 days a week through though she can often be found at the center on her days off as well. When she isn't at the center, she's likely to be at home with her elderly mother, tending a large garden of fruit trees, flowers, and vegetables. So here's Ibbitsum's story, as told in her own words and edited by Voice of Witness. All my life, I have lived under occupation. I was born in 1960 in Batir. Life in the village was simple. Most of my neighbors were farmers, and when I was a child, people from Batir would travel into Jerusalem to sell produce in the markets there. My parents had some land that they farmed, and my father was also a chef. When I was very young, he worked at a hotel in Amman, Jordan, and we'd see him on the weekends. Then, after 1967, he began working as a chef at the American Colony Hotel in Jerusalem. My mother stayed home and raised me and my siblings. There were 9 of us. We didn't have TVs, and there were no computers, of course, and no plastic toys to keep us distracted. I think we were lucky to not have those things. Instead, we used nature. We'd play in the fields, climb trees, make toys ourselves out of sticks and stones. It seemed then like there weren't divisions between neighbors, despite religion or other differences. We were all part of one culture in many ways. I remember my mother coloring eggs every Easter. It was something that had been passed down for generations. It wasn't a Christian thing or a Muslim thing. It was a Palestinian thing to mark Easter that way. I must have joined in all the games when I was very young. But then I developed a disability as an infant. When I was 2.5 years old, my mother was carrying me past a clinic in town one day. A clinic nurse stopped us and told my mother she should come in and that she should get me the vaccine for polio. So I was given a vaccine. That night I had a fever and I couldn't move my right arm or left leg. Over the next few years, I was able to regain function of my limbs, but my left leg grew in shorter than my right. At age 4, I started wearing a brace to help me walk. It was just bad luck that we had walked past that clinic. I had to get used to people treating me differently because of my disability. Even people's facial expressions when meeting me were different. They didn't react to me as if I were a normal child. When I was at school, I was excluded from physical education activities and some field trips that required a lot of walking, and that was really difficult. I also had learning disabilities. My teacher beat me once in 4th grade because I was nearly failing all subjects. Education was important to my parents, so they were very unhappy that I was struggling. My father had only gone through the 4th grade, so he could read and write. My mother had never been to school. But they wanted more for their kids, especially me. Because I had a disability, they wanted me to do well in school so that I'd be independent when I grew up and not need to rely on anybody. Then in the 5th grade, I succeeded on an exam, and the feeling was very strange. The teacher handed the paper back and said the work was excellent. I couldn't believe I'd done anything that would make her say that. I couldn't believe that it was my paper that was excellent. I thought she'd made a mistake. I think it's common for children who aren't used to success. They don't realize it's their effort that leads to excellence. They think it's by accident. But I tasted success just that one time, and I realized I loved it. I just had to convince myself that it wasn't a mistake. Then I continued to try hard at school, and I started to realize my potential. In 1977, I was accepted to a boarding school in Jerusalem. It was actually right next to the American Colony Hotel, so I could see my father sometimes. I'd also go home on holidays. It was still relatively easy to travel into and out of Jerusalem then. I did well enough in high school and got accepted to the University of Jordan in Amman. I started there in the fall of 1979, and I studied economics. I loved university, and I wasn't lonely. Other than college students who became friends, I had a lot of family living and working in Amman. But I still felt homesick sometimes, and I started to understand what made Palestine feel special. In my last year at university, the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish came to read at a theater on campus. I got tickets to go, but when I arrived, the theater was absolutely packed, and the streets outside were full, And there were so many Palestinians in Jordan, and we all wanted to hear this poet remind us of what it meant to be Palestinian. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Women's Magazine on MutinyRadio.fm. I'm Global Val. If you want to know more about what I do, you can check out my blog. It's globalval.blogspot.com. That's G-O-L... No. G-L-O-B-A-L-V-A-L. globalval.blogspot.com. And I'm reading from the latest Voice of Witness book put out by Voice of Witness called Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation. And I've been reading the narrative of a director of a cultural center in Gishan called, and the woman's name is Ibitsam Ilzgayer. Here's the next part of her story. And this part is called It Raised a Lot of Emotions for Me. I returned home in 1984 and had one of the hardest years of my life. I had just spent many years working extremely hard to make something of myself, to become independent from my parents, economically, emotionally, socially, so that I wouldn't be a burden to them. Then I returned to Palestine and found I couldn't get a job. Because of my economics degree, I wanted to work in a bank, but there weren't any jobs in that field available, and I couldn't find any other sort of work. So I lived with my parents for a year and they supported me. I was very depressed during that time. Then one day in 1985, I read a classified ad put up by the BASR, the Bethlehem Arab Society for Rehabilitation, which was founded in 1960. It's a major charitable organization in Great Britain dedicated to global disability care. So I read a classified ad put up by the BASR. And they, BASR, they were offering to train workers in the field called community-based rehabilitation, which is about helping people with disabilities overcome them by working with the family, the whole community really, to integrate the disabled into daily life. At first, I wanted nothing to do with that sort of work. I had an economics degree, and I'd spent my whole life trying to get away from any limitations imposed by my own disability. I simply didn't want to think about disabilities, but I desperately wanted a job, so I applied. I trained with the BASR for a year. It was hard. I worked with children who had hearing issues, blindness, mental health issues. The work brought up a lot of emotions for me, and it took some time to become comfortable around the children. But I kept receiving praise from my supervisors, and they made me feel like I was useful. In 1986, I began working in some of the refugee camps in Bethlehem as well, and that helped open my eyes. I got to see some of the real trauma that was happening in the community. That same year, the Bethlehem Arab Society for Rehabilitation, BASR, opened a community center for people with mental health disabilities, and I helped to run it. It was a very busy time for me. Then the following year, 1987, the first Intifada began. Note, The first Intifada was an uprising throughout the West Bank and Gaza against Israeli military occupation. It began in December of 1987 and lasted until 1993. Intifada in Arabic means to shake off. I remember it started just after I got my driver's license. I bought an old used car on November 30th of that year, and I was really proud of myself. I was starting to feel quite independent. Then I set out to drive to work for the first time on December 6th, and I ended up driving through streets littered with stones and burning tires. It was the first day of the Intifada, and I couldn't make it to work that day. There was too much happening in the streets, so I spent the day listening to the news with my family. Thinkers before fighters. The idea of starting a community center came to me in 1990. It was the middle of the first Intifada, and the streets were dangerous places to play for children. Aside from the threat of getting caught in fighting, children were sometimes targeted by soldiers. Sometimes children threw stones at soldiers, but other times soldiers would find children simply playing traditional games with stones. Many children, even young children, were arrested by soldiers who saw them playing these games. So the idea of the center started as a way to give children a safe place to play. Also, at that time, many schools were frequently closed by military order, so children had to stay home for long stretches of time. Sometimes the Israeli military would even use schools as checkpoints to control the area. The school in Batir was used as a military camp. These realities came together to make us want to start a center. The BASR was able to establish the Giras Cultural Center in Bethlehem in late 1993, early 94. In the West Bank at that time, the school curriculum was Jordanian. In Gaza, it was Egyptian. So when I went to school, I studied a Jordanian curriculum. We never studied anything about Palestine or its history. We never saw a Palestinian map. We studied the history of Jordan, of China, of Germany, of England. I remember learning about all the families who ruled England, but nothing connected to our history. Nothing connected to our geography. Nothing connected to our culture. When we started the center, we wanted to educate children about Palestinian culture, Palestinian music, Palestinian poetry. We have famous poets like Mahmoud Darwish, but it was forbidden for us to read from them or read other Palestinian writers. If the Israelis caught us with a book from certain Palestinian writers, we might end up in jail. We couldn't have Palestinian flags, political symbols, anything considered propaganda for a Palestinian state. Everything could get us into trouble. My family, like most in the West Bank, had a hiding spot at home. For us, it was at the back of the cupboard. When we heard there were going to be raids on our houses, we'd quickly hide our forbidden books of poetry or flags or whatever behind a false wall at the back of that cupboard. With these restrictions in mind, one of our first goals at the center was to provide a sense of Palestinian culture to children. We wanted the center to be inclusive, so we didn't allow any religious symbols or symbols of any specific political parties in the center. We had children from Christian communities and Muslim, urban and rural, from refugee camps, from relatively well-off neighborhoods. I also continued to work with children who had disabilities, but we integrated them with the other kids in the classroom. Whether they were blind or hearing impaired or had learning disabilities, they were all integrated. After working this way in the cultural center, I even began to forget my own disability completely. I had other things to worry about and work on. One day, I saw myself in a reflection in the window while in the street, and I remembered I didn't walk as other people do. I had simply forgotten for a time that I had any disability at all, and I was really happy for myself. Overcoming my own disability was no longer my focus. In the center, I tried to make students thinkers before fighters. I did everything I could to keep them in the center or make sure they went straight home to keep them from dangerous interactions with the soldiers. We lost some children. Some had a strong feeling that they wanted to fight. It was very difficult. Of course, they didn't always understand what they were doing, but they weren't just imitating other people who were fighting in the streets. They were expressing their own anger from experiencing humiliation and violence. Not long after the center was established, I had begun working there. I had a chance to travel abroad for the first time. I went with a friend to help her apply for a scholarship offered by the British consul to study in England. While there, I applied myself, sort of on a whim, but it turns out I won the scholarship. When I got the call that I had won, the consular office gave me 2 weeks to get ready for travel. So for the first time, I got to leave Palestine, other than my college years in Jordan. I studied for a year at Newcastle University and learned administration and counseling. It was a good experience, even though it was hard. I felt homesick from the moment the plane took off. I was away from home from the fall of 1994 to the spring of 1995. I got to travel a lot throughout England, and that was interesting, but I wanted to go home the whole time. I remember I had very little money, and what I had, I'd used to call my family. I'd spend hours asking my brothers about neighbors I barely knew. Old men who hung out on the street that I never talked to, for instance, just because I wanted to know everything that was happening at home. When I completed all my coursework, I was expected to stay for the graduation ceremony and some parties, but I told the school administration I didn't want any parties. I just wanted to go home and see my family. Again, reading from it's the oral history we're hearing from Ibitsam Izgayer, from the most recent and newest Voice of Witness book called Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation. I'm Global Val. Thanks for listening to Women's Magazine.
Tout est dit dans Umberto Eco. J'ai besoin de vrai love, illico presto. Vrai love, illico presto. Parce que tout le reste, c'est du bluff. On veut tous du vrai love, illico presto. Petit, je jouais au foot. La balle, mais il y avait le goal. Quand je marquais, elle levait les bras. Je la regardais, mais ne lui parlais pas. J'avais des activités multiples avec sa tunique. Elle était
mais
unique.
Claude, tu la niques.
Peut-être j'étais trop clean. J'aurais dû la caresser le soir sur la colline. Je descends de l'homme sage. Lui ai juste fait la bise avant qu'elle ne déménage. Toutes mes amies trouvent ça beau. On a besoin de vrai love. On me connaît, les rapports sont faussés. De l'ère moderne au Moyen-Âge, malgré l'image, je garde le QI sage. Où est le sens de la vie? La plus belle beauté n'est-elle pas celle d'une amie? Reviens en écho, Umberto Eco, mes mots. Les pages parlaient de l'ère du faux. Chez moi, je regarde le mur. Suis-je assez mûr pour le droit au mur? Fin de siècle, il faut du vrai love.
réseaux. Fuck le bluff, le monde est trop complexe. Vrai love, quand il y copresto. Vrai love, il y copresto. Que tout le reste est super peu, il nous faut du vrai love, illico presto.
rhymes with attitude. Now do promotion and TV, and you still come and see we down the hill cascade. And keep away the masquerade. Dreamed of ringing voices. You promised me poems. You promised me.
So thanks for listening to Women's Magazine. I'm Global Val. You're listening to MutinyRadio.fm. We're broadcasting live here in San Francisco in the Mission District at the corner of 21st and Florida. I was reading today from the latest book put out by the nonprofit organization called Voice of Witness, and their aim is to tell oral history about ongoing human rights crises. Their latest book, Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation. I was reading from a chapter with Ibit Sam, cultural director, director of a cultural center. And tune in next week for more. But coming up next, right here on the Mutiny Radio in the corner of 21st and Florida, you're invited in person or otherwise to join us for the Common Thread Collective that is open, open door, open mic, open minds, open hearts, and open arms, is Diamond Dave. So stay tuned if you're listening live, and if you're listening on the podcast, thank you for downloading the podcast. And you can find out more about what's up at globalval.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time. Or it's a radio, so you won't see me.
Okay, here's what we're doing here. We're going to integrate two very important things, and those are intelligence and sports.
In hockey, you must score a goal, which one cannot do if between me and the net there's no hole. Most goalies are quick, react the drop of a hat, but I don't need to be quick when I got so much for that.
What do you do with your 15 on treadmill? You play goalie. What do you do with your 15 on treadmill? You play goalie.
You can try the wrist shot, slap shot, there's no getting through. I told you 10 times, you cannot fake out blubber, dude. I won't get tired, cause I'll just lie on my side, so the other teams won't copy. I'll be signed at the dead of channel 29 on the telly. I'm limiting the kick save and only block my belly. Me and Giorgio Zina, I'll be a new sensation. The NHL cannot let me play, cause that's discrimination. With the 15 on dead bound, you play goalie. What do you do with your 15 on dead bound? You play goalie.
We're winning! Yeah, we're winning!